And welcome, folks. This is Chip Tatum, your host tonight for the Pegasus File. You know, if you have a question about anything on the show, feel free to send me an email, chip@chiptatum.com, chip@chiptatum.com, and I'm happy to answer it if I can. One of the questions I received recently was, how do you know if you're being a target of MK Ultra or of brainwashing or of remote viewing? How do you know if you're a target of one of these powerful assets of the government? Well, at NIH, in the Infectious Diseases Unit, which was a cover a few years ago before it was destroyed in about 2009, this is what I was told while I was on tour there. And one of the lead psychiatrists told me, Chip, this is how you know. He said, sometimes your vision will get fuzzy, or color vision will distort, may go to yellows, greens, even grays. Another indication is you'll feel like an electric shock all the way through your body. You'll just and it's numbing to the body. There's no doubt that you're feeling this to your body. Sometimes it disables a person completely. So those are two ways that you know that a remote viewer has been targeting you. Those are only two ways. The NIH and Bethesda facility, they didn't specify any more than that that I can talk about. So, but I did give you those two. So if any of you have ever felt or had those symptoms, perhaps it's not just a medical issue. Perhaps you were a target of MK Ultra 2 or the later version, a Sandman. I hope you're prepared. I had leaked out a little bit about what we're going to talk about tonight, and what we're going to talk about is something that, here I go again, goes back a bit. But then again, we have a version 2, which is a current version. So let's get right into it. I'm going to give you that hint again on what we're going to talk about tonight. President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
I get tired of saying that defense is to be made an excuse for wasting dollars. I don't believe we should pay 1 cent for defense more than we have to.
I seriously question an increase in the Pentagon budget in the face of the department's recent Inspector General's report. How can we seriously consider a $50 billion increase in the defense budget when DOD's own auditors, say the department cannot account for $2.3 trillion in transactions in 1 year alone?
A smug Donald Rumsfeld.
It is terrifying. It is such a monumental task. I have met with two former officials of the Pentagon who served in the budget and controller and those areas. And I've mused over the fact that I've read some of these things and asked what they thought.
Here's John Hamry, a Defense Department comptroller, trying to make excuses for their inept work or their fraud.
We process nearly 10 million paychecks a month. 10 million times to get things screwed up. I've had my pay screwed up 6 times since I've been in the department. And it's really bad when you screw up your boss's pay.
Laughing about it. Ha-ha, joking about it. Here comes Rumsfeld again. Hold on, folks.
I doubt, to be honest, that people inside the department are going to be capable of sorting this out.
I doubt that you have an honest bone in your damn body.
I have a feeling it's going to take some folks from outside to come in and look at this and put in place a process that over a period, and I regret to say, but I've seen how long things take. I think it's going to take a period of years to sort it out, and I think it'll probably take the cooperation of the Congress.
But it didn't take years, because the day after this testimony, 9/11 hit, and something destroyed the offices in the Pentagon and the files that were needed for an audit.
To try to get the system so that you can actually manage the financial aspects of that institution rather than simply report on things that have happened imperfectly.
There's more oversight over the Head Start program than there is over the entire military budget.
It's a terrible record, and it's preposterous that the Defense Department doesn't know what's happened to this money.
This situation's a disgrace. It tells me that we can't meet our constitutional obligations to the taxpayers of our country to make sure that things are honestly and legally spent.
We were told major cuts in education programs, and then we read, well, you know, $500 million is paid per year that isn't owed.
It is an incredible thing that we arm the world and then turn around and come to Congress and say, look at all these weapons out there. They're almost superior to ours. They're comparable to ours. Well, of course they are. They're ours. We sold them to them.
Since the end of the Cold War, we've sold more military weapons than the rest of the world combined.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
My name is Jack Shanahan, Vice Admiral, U.S. Navy, retired. One of our nuclear bombs blows up Hiroshima 15 times over. 5 devastates Russia. After that, this is how many the U.S. has left. I feel safe reducing nuclear weapons. Do you?
That number is around 15,000 additional nuclear weapons. I'm sure you've heard that number several times in the past, that $2.3 trillion was missing from the Army coffers. And they had no response, no idea where the heck that money went. And since 9/11 happened, the day after that was announced, there was no way in the world they were ever going to find out where that money went. Want to know something about the Army budget and where that money comes from and what it's done with it? I can even tell you something about one way that we were able to confiscate those monies and use them in black operations. So imagine this. You recruit someone within the Department of Defense, Department of the Army. We're going to talk about the Department of Army right now. Only one branch of the military services. You recruit someone out of the Department of the Army that has access to comptroller programs and running the checks. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, a lot of that was run off of cards. And that processor would simply take a nickel out of every paycheck. That's right. 5 cents out of every paycheck. Now, you heard the comptroller talk about how many paychecks they process a month. 10 million paychecks. So a nickel out of every paycheck for 10 million paychecks ends up being around $500,000 a month from one military service. How many military services are there out there? Huh? Yeah, that's right. So the CIA had assets in both the military comptroller's offices, Department of Defense comptroller's offices, every single government comptroller's office that existed, the CIA had assets in. So that adds up to billions of dollars in black money that's never accounted for. Now, you know, let me qualify that real quick for you. They were recruited out of the accounting and finance offices of those military services and government offices. But where's all that money come from to begin with? It comes from the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, which is an act of Congress provided every year, which gives the Department of Defense their budget to work with. So Congress allocates a certain amount of money for each of the military departments. You have the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard. And then in addition to that, they have another tranche of money set aside for the Department of Defense and their other operations and in their, I guess, experimental programs and their testing and evaluation programs. So you can imagine how many trillions of dollars this is that's set aside. Now, I talked a moment ago about what happens just a nickel out of every paycheck with the paychecks going out to both the military and civilians working under the Department of Defense. And then if you look at all the other government offices, you can imagine how enormous that number is that the CIA was pulling in for their black ops program simply because Congress needed oversight and cut their funds and required them to report to Congress to run a black op. Well, they couldn't do that. You can't report to Congress if you're going to do a black op. What happens is Congress is never in accord with anything, and someone there is going to go out and ruin the black op, ruin the operation. They're going to go out and they're going to tell someone that something's coming. That's what happened in Grenada. A congressman's office, when announced that the Grenada invasion was on, the congressman's office said that's inhumane. They called the Cubans before the attack on Grenada, and so the Cuban military sitting on the airport was sitting and waiting with their anti-aircraft gun, just waiting to shoot us down. And boy, they put a lot of holes in a lot of aircraft and in some bodies. So on the intelligence side, black ops needed money, and that's one way that they would get it. Another way, look, accounting and finance, comptroller's office, they're inept. They're idiots. Damn straight they are. So you start sending bills in on invoices that don't exist. It doesn't matter. They pay it. So they were sending all these invoices in under names of Boeing or whatever, or even making up company names, running proprietary companies, and the government was paying those invoices, slapping that money out just like it was candy. And that's because that money was made available through the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. So what else is in those NDAAs and National Defense Authorization Acts? A lot of times there's some attachments, and some of those attachments are pretty fierce attachments. Some of those attachments take away your rights. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about a program that was designed back in the 50s, a program called Mockingbird. What was Mockingbird? Well, it wasn't a song by James Taylor and Carly Simon, as the introduction had. It was a program where the government, where the CIA, recruited major media to work for them, to send out propaganda. Now, it was originally designed for propaganda going out on the international side, out to the world, to try to persuade them and put forth what America wanted the world to think. Well, you know, a lot of that was done through U.S. media. And who else was reading those reports? Who else was reading those articles? Who else was listening to that on television? Who else was listening to that on the radio? Well, the American people were. So they were getting filled with the same damn propaganda that we were trying to shift off overseas to the leaders overseas and to the bad guys overseas. It actually fell under what was called the Smith-Mund Act. What was the Smith-Mund Act, Chip? It was an act which allowed us to work in what was called at the time public diplomacy. Here's how it is explained. The original legislation authorizes the U.S. Senate, or the U.S. State Department, to communicate to audiences outside of the borders of the United States through several means, several medias, through broadcasting, face-to-face contacts, exchanges, including educational, cultural, and technical. Well, that worked for years. But then came something a little different. Something that's called the Smith-Mund Modernization Act of 2012. That's right, they modernized it. And what's that mean? It means they included other means of media. Any means of media communications and engagement, including online activities. The publishing of books, magazines, and other media of communication and engagement. Funding for these activities comes from other legislation passed by the U.S. Congress called appropriations. The original act was actually called the U.S. Information and Educational Exchange Act of 1948. I like the way that's put, huh? And then in 2012, they moved it over to the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act of 2012. Now, taking the 1948 Act, CIA, Department of Defense, State Department were able to put together a program whereby they could recruit media moguls, entertainers, anyone who had a public audience, recruit them into what was called then Operation Mockingbird. However, Operation Mockingbird, it said, was terminated years ago. Or was it? Or do we have a modern Operation Mockingbird tied to the Modernization Act? You know, press manipulation has always been paramount in the concerns of the CIA, as with the Pentagon. So here's just a brief history. At the height of the Cold War, the CIA developed its very own stable of writers, editors, and publishers, swelling to as many as 3,000 individuals that it paid to scribble agency propaganda under a program called Operation Mockingbird. The disinformation network was supervised by the late Philip Graham, former publisher of the Washington Post. You think the Washington Post is still doing that? Oh, hell yes. Almost from its founding in 1947, the CIA had journalists on its payroll, a fact acknowledged in the ringing tones by the agency in its announcement in 1976 when G.H.W. Bush took over from William Colby, that effective immediately, the CIA will not enter into any paid or contract relationship with any full-time or part-time news correspondent accredited by any U.S. news service, newspaper, periodical, radio, or television network. The key to that, remember that year, 1976. Though the announcement was stressed that the CIA would continue to welcome the voluntary, unpaid cooperation of journalists, there is no reason to believe that the agency actually stopped covert payments and payoffs to the Fourth Estate. In 1975, Frank Church was commissioned to run an investigation on the CIA that would later become known as the Church Committee. In February of 1976, as a result of some of the findings, which had actually not even been published yet, President Ford enacted the Intelligence Oversight Board, the IOB, which he established in 1976, I think it was February of 1976, as a White House entity with oversight responsibility for the legality and propriety of intelligence activities. The board, which reports to the president, is charged primarily with preparing reports of intelligence activities that the IOB believes may be unlawful or contrary to executive order or presidential directive. The board may also refer such reports to the Attorney General. This standard assists the President in ensuring that highly sensitive intelligence activities comply with law and presidential directive.
So here you have CIA, DIA, Department of Defense, whatever, intelligence operations going on that have to go through a review, normally prior to the operation. And then comes in the Senate Oversight Committee and the other oversight committees, which are required to approve an operation for funding for that operation. If not approved, or if not if it doesn't seem to fall in line with the presidential directives or the NSC directives, then the operation is not approved and it's not funded. Well, do you really think that these operatives who were used to having money quick, having money fast, having money when they wanted, having everything that they need for their operation in hand, you think they're really going to go to Congress and ask them permission to do this? I could see that. Yeah, sure. So why not start your own funding process outside the purview of Congress, outside the purview of the NSC, and even the president? So this was done circa 1976, and guess who was the department, or who was the DCI at the time for the CIA? George H.W. Bush. But look, we think about Operation Mockingbird and the ability for the CIA to infiltrate the media and dictate to the media. I mean, CIA workers would literally write the script. Yeah. Operation Mockingbird was so successful, it molded and changed and guided the minds of American people. What do you call that? You call it brainwashing. That's right. Operation Mockingbird was a brainwash technique, very successful. And do you think it ended? No. Now we're in Mockingbird 2. And you don't think that's true? Listen to what the media has to say about any given article and how it's passed on from media source to media source to media source to media source. Listen to this.
You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
In consumer news, economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take some of the spring out of the Easter Bunny step this year.
Economic factors may take the spring out of the step of the Easter Bunny this year.
Holy crap! The Easter Bunny's the CIA agent. The video shows the media follows scripts much the same as presidents read off the teleprompter. This is not by accident. They do this to imprint a thought or idea in your brain, much like a song you can't get out of your head. Here's more.
Final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
The final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
The final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
The final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
The final days of the campaign can get a little
salty.
The final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
Well, the final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
The final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
The final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
The final days of the campaign can get a little salty.
As you probably noticed, the final days of the campaign have been, well, you might call them just a little salty.
When you set out to influence and persuade people to action, when the campaign is tremendous, nationwide in scope, don't think that it just happens. Something has to be done to get millions of people to think the thought you want them to think. And then you get them to act on that thought. There's a war on for your mind.
I scream, you scream. You know the rest.
I scream, you scream, you know the rest.
I scream, you scream, you know the rest.
I scream, you scream, you know the rest. Well, I scream, you scream, you know the rest.
I scream, you scream, well, you know the rest.
I scream, you scream, well, you know the rest.
I scream, you scream, we all, well, you know the rest.
Got it.
I scream, you scream.
Retail calendar that can be enjoyed from a desk or the couch.
Enjoyed from a desk or a couch.
Enjoyed from a desk or maybe the couch.
Enjoyed from a desk or the couch.
Enjoyed from a desk or the couch.
Enjoyed from the desk or even the couch.
Enjoyed from a desk or the couch.
From a desk or the couch.
From a desk or the couch.
From a desk or a couch.
From a desk or your couch.
From the desk. Or the couch.
From your desk or the couch.
From a desk or the couch.
From a desk or a couch.
From your desk or the couch.
From a desk or the couch.
From a desk or couch.
From a desk or the couch.
From a desk or even the couch.
From a desk or the couch.
Joy from a desk or a couch.
From a desk
or the couch.
From a desk or the couch. Or wherever you like, as long as you got internet.
A preventative vaccine is in sight.
But soon, perhaps within a year, there may be a vaccine. A vaccine available to all that may be the answer.
You see, there's so much hope now, because this year we may have a vaccine that will stop crippling polio.
Help your National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis to store up supplies of the Dr. Salk polio vaccine.
It's all because of a thing called polio. Now, I know you've heard of polio because you've been given your polio shots.
But I was just wondering whether or not the discovery of the Salk vaccine made you forget about the kids who are still crippled.
I'm asking for children who are casualties on the battlefields of infantile paralysis. For them, vaccine came too late.
For them, the vaccine came too late.
The Salk vaccine came too late.
But these boys and girls didn't get their polio shots in time.
As a result of polio, the vaccine can't help them now.
Yes, but to fight polio this year will take a lot of money. $64 million.
$64 million? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Send your dimes and dollars to your local March of Dimes headquarters.
And send your mercy dollars and dimes to your local March of Dimes headquarters.
Send your contributions to your local March of Dimes headquarters today.
Send your dimes and your dollars into the nearest March of Dimes headquarters.
Send your dimes and dollars to your local March of Dimes headquarters.
Give every dime and dollar that you can spare to the 1954 March of Dimes.
And that's what every good American should do. Join the March of Dimes.
Yes, every good American. Listen to what they all have to say in the major media. Yes, send your money to the March of Dimes. I would say let the brainwashing begin. But hell, that's too late. It's already well entrenched. I don't think there's one of you out there listening to me today that has not been influenced by Operation Mockingbird or Mockingbird 2. And I haven't talked about Mockingbird 2 yet, but you heard at the end of one of the trios.
Years, the CIA waged a media campaign in Europe to combat communist propaganda. Arthur Cox, a former CIA operative whom we talked to this week, called it fighting fire with fire. And as an illustration, he referred to Portugal today, to the Portuguese press. And he said, imagine a story appearing, singing the praises of a left-wing political figure there. Presumably, says Cox, it's a puff piece planted by the Russians to promote one of their favorites. We answer back with a counter story describing the same guy as a villain and a scoundrel. This kind of competition in the newspapers requires extensive payments to European reporters, and in some cases, the CIA actually created or sustained whole news organizations. As you heard Stu Lurie say in his talk, the CIA bought part ownership of an Italian paper, the Daily American, paying between $80,000 and $90,000 to keep the paper printing stories that support the American interests in the Mediterranean. And a few weeks ago, a British magazine, Time Out, discovered in a PhD thesis out of Oxford evidence that the CIA created a British news organization called Forum World Features. It's a Delaware corporation owned on the record from 1966 to 1973 by John Hay Whitney, the former publisher of the Herald Tribune. And from time to time, supposedly this news service published stories sympathetic to U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Mr. Whitney says he has no comment on any CIA association with Forum World Features. The editors, who may not have known, say the charges are false. But former CIA man Arthur Cox points out that some of the misinformation and propaganda planted by the agencies in the European press comes back to the United States and misinforms us, too. And he wonders whether the price we all pay in this kind of competition is worth it.
And so the problem comes up today before the House Intelligence Committee. Here's Chairman Otis Pike to start things off.
Witness this afternoon is Mr. William Colby, who has been up on Capitol Hill before. And in fact, you've walked up quite a few hills and down again, it seems to me, Mr. Colby, in the last few days. I would like to state, before we start, not only by there is a great deal of commentary and comment about whether or not the director of Central Intelligence has been, quote, forthcoming, end quote, and that's the word that is used all the time, as to your relations with Capitol Hill. I've heard comments to the effect that you have been too forthcoming with Capitol Hill. It has been my own experience and judgment that if you are asked precisely the right question, you will give an honest answer.
Okay, so here we are, an interview with my ex-boss, Bill Colby. Now, one thing you need to understand, and the congressman is going to get to it here, when we're interviewed, we only answer the question that's asked. We don't go beyond that. And depending on how the question is asked is how we answer. So they have to be very specific. If they want a specific answer, they need to be very specific. Otherwise, we just give a general answer or a political answer, which is no answer.
You do not lead us into those areas which would help us know what the right question was to ask. You do not make it easy for us to answer the right question. Anyone who thinks that you have been running back and forth to Capitol Hill with briefcases bulging with secrets which you are eager to bestow upon us hasn't sat on my side of the desk. And in my judgment, you have done a very responsible job for your agency at a time when your agency had great problems, and I welcome you back here, not as a friend, but as a respected adversary.
So here we are in the 75-76 time frame, where the Oversight Intelligence Oversight Committees is trying to gain control of the CIA and covert activities, especially after President Ford had signed the act allowing oversight by Congress. So here we go with some more.
It is my understanding, Mr. Colby, that you have an opening statement to give us this afternoon on our basic subject matter, which comes under your heading of personnel and my heading or our heading of risks. And what we are interested in looking at is where the CIA has people stashed away throughout the United States of America and overseas. And I realize that some of this will have to be done in executive session, but I would like to stay in open session as long as we can. Please proceed. Mr. Chairman, thank you, and thank you for the remarks. Mr. Chairman, CIA personnel, when they go overseas, obviously must go under some other title. This is, in some cases, a title of another agency of the government. In some cases, it is of some other title outside of the government. For reasons of continuity, CIA personnel sometimes have to retain that identification while they serve a tour within the United States. This is a headquarters tour, and they are not using that cover for another reason during that period, but merely to provide some continuity. There are certain activities that we have done within the United States that do need some other identification than CIA. I think I've explained on previous occasions the need for covering a security investigation so that it does not highlight the fact that the person being investigated will shortly become a member of the CIA, because we do not want that reputation to be around. But I think you have asked two particular areas be covered, Mr. Chairman. One, the subject of details to other government agency, as distinct from the use of other covers, other agencies' cover. And secondly, the relationship with the field of journalism generally in our operations.
And so here we're going to begin talking about Mockingbird and the applications of Mockingbird in those years, prior and currently. And then later we're going to talk about what I call Mockingbird version 2.0.
With respect to the last part of that, the journalist area, Mr. Chairman, I obviously cannot go into detail as to the identifications or the people involved, but I think I can sketch a few general points here within which we can go into full detail in the executive session. In the first place, as people equally interested in foreign affairs, CIA people and journalists frequently run into each other and exchange ideas. This occurs both abroad, in our stations abroad, and in the United States. In the past year, for example, CIA has received in our building for discussions of foreign events about 100 journalists for a detailed discussion and analysis of some foreign situation. In that time, we have answered something like 1,200 or 1,300 telephone inquiries from journalists about some development abroad, some foreign development, on which the journalist is seeking the advice that and the judgments of our analysts about that situation. I think this is both perfectly proper, Mr. Chairman, and I think it is more than perfectly proper. I think it is part of the effort we in CIA are making to ensure that our product is useful not only to the elements of the executive branch who need it directly, but also to the Congress, where we do make much of our information available to the congressional committees. And we do this on both a regular and periodic basis, and we do it in response to specific requests for testimony on the situation in some foreign situation. Likewise, I think it important that our public benefit from, to the extent feasible, within the limits of the requirement to keep sensitive sources secret, and for that reason, we do respond to these journalistic inquiries about some situation abroad. The numbers I gave you are those in which we discuss the substance. I'm not including the number of journalists that have been curious about the state of the intelligence community these days, or CIA, or any of those things. That's a totally separate category. And it's a larger total number, I might add. But beyond that, Mr. Chairman, we have over the years had an operational relationship with a certain number of journalists overseas. We have worked with these people to help us on our foreign intelligence responsibilities. In some cases, they can provide us information that we ask them about. In some cases, they can make contacts with people that it is difficult for an official of an embassy or an American mission abroad to be in touch with. And for this reason, we have on occasion used people who have connections with journalism for this, this purpose. Under our own restraints, we have been very careful about this, and in recent years we have even further strengthened our restrictions on this matter. We have taken particular caution to ensure that our operations are focused abroad and are not focused at the United States in the sense of collecting information about the United States or, on the other hand, influencing the opinion of the American people about things that, from a CIA point of view. We have dropped contacts and relationships with journalists and others in the past couple of years where we felt that there was some belief that that relationship could be construed as an effort to influence a major circulation American journal, for example, or that a particular project would be aimed at affecting U.S. public opinion through media operations. In order to carry out this policy, we have a careful regulatory control procedure in our operations directorate, and our current regulations require the approval of a senior level of the agency with respect to any connection with American journalist or media personnel.
But then you're going to hear about the gray area, independent contractors.
And as a further matter of policy, even with those journalists that we do deal with, and it is a very small number, which I would certainly give you in the executive session, Mr. Chairman, we do not attempt to influence what they put in their U.S. journals. What they do with respect to their own journal is their business, and we do not tell them what stories to write or what subjects to cover. We do not, at this time, employ any staff members of regular U.S. general circulation journals. You may recall there was some publicity a couple of years ago at which I undertook the commitment to terminate any such relationships, and over these past 2 years we have terminated those relationships. We have certain other contacts with people with considerably less connection with American journals or considerably less of a standing as a general circulation journal, and those we have continued because we believe that their material does not affect American public opinion in any substantial basis, or that their material is viewed as something coming from the outside and something that the journal has a full choice over whether it wishes to keep it or not. Turning to the other subject, Mr. Chairman, the subject of detailees. In common with the other agencies of the government, CIA has a program which permits the detail of our employees to other agencies. The detail of agency personnel is approved when the assignment is determined to be beneficial to the career development of an individual, or where it can make a contribution to a foreign intelligence-related activity. Employees on such details normally continue to receive their agency entitlements during such a detail. In a sense, I was one of those at one time, Mr. Chairman, when I left the agency on leave without pay and served in the Agency for International Development and the Department of State when I was in Vietnam, and then later returned to the agency. I was not under a cover at that time. I was a detail. Reimbursement to CIA for such details depends upon the individual circumstances of each detail. If the employee performs agency-related duties or is a participant in a joint operation of a national intelligence program or is assigned as part of a career development plan, then we will reimburse the agency that he works for his services. If, on the other hand, if he moves totally to another agency and works for it on its functions for a period where he is essentially doing their work, then they will not be reimbursed during that period. The receiving agency will pay for his full entitlements. I might add here that no such details are affected without a full coordination with the appropriate officials in the agency to which the individual is assigned or detailed, so that there is no penetration of the detail without the knowledge of its senior management. As of the 21st of October of this year, there were 104 employees of CIA on detail to other components of the United States government. Of these, we were reimbursed for 27, and we were not reimbursed for 77. Now, there are also times, Mr. Chairman, when CIA has a need for a skill of an individual who comes from another government agency. CIA, particularly in its earlier days, was heavily staffed by military personnel who were detailed, and a number of the senior officers in the Army today spent a tour of two or three years in CIA at some point in the early 50s. Also, there may be of activities of common concern to the CIA and to another government agency on a matter of common concern to the intelligence community. If these situations exist, we make arrangements for a reimbursable or a non-reimbursable, depending on the circumstances, detail from the other agency to CIA. As of the 21st of October of this year, we had 179 details in from such other agencies of the government, of which we were reimbursed for 80. The others, of course, were non-reimbursed, and a total of 99. I think that gives the overall picture of these two subjects, Mr. Chairman. I'd be delighted to answer the questions and to the degree of which I can.
Well, I don't know how far we're going to be able to go in an open session, but we're going to try.
Chairman Otis Pike.
When did you last have... Now, I'm going to withdraw that. Do you now have people who are being paid by the CIA on anything which you referred to as a major circulation American journal?
We have no staff members of any such major journal.
That was not the question. The question was, do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to anything which you called, quote, a major circulation American journal?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do. We have some who are in the category of freelancer or stringer or something of that nature abroad. Individuals who are not considered a part of the staff of that journal.
I'm not going to ask you the names or the numbers. I am going to ask you this, however. Do you have any people who are on the staffs of major circulation American journals without who are contributing to major circulation American journals who you are paying without the knowledge of the management of the major circulation American journals?
Yes, we do. Stringers who are submitting occasional pieces or frequent pieces to various journals, that we have not told the management about them, but they are considered as non-staff members of that journal. They're independent contractors.
Do you have any people at the present time who are paid full-time by the CIA, who also write for major circulation American journals?
We do have abroad some of our employees who are paid for their services by CIA, who also submit pieces occasionally. It's a very small number, but we do have people who submit pieces to other two American journals.
Do you have any people paid by the CIA who are working for television networks?
This, I think, gets into the kind of getting into the details, Mr. Chairman, that I'd like to get into in executive session. I think if we begin to break the question down into the component parts, we begin to focus things a bit.
Well, when you refer to major circulation American journals, are you referring to both written media and visual media?
Yes, I do. I'm sorry, I should have made that clear.
All right.
Now remember what I said about how to question a spook. You have to be very specific. So listen to these guys question Colby. It's like pulling teeth.
Do you have any people being paid by the CIA who are contributing to the national news services? And by that, I'm referring to AP and UPI.
Well, again, I think we're getting into the kind of detail, Mr. Chairman, that I'd prefer to...
Well, that's a big yes, isn't it?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Juan Dillon's a Democrat from California questioning William Colby.
In the past several years, several full-time employees of major domestic media instruments were also full-time employees of the Central Intelligence Agency.
I think I can answer that better, Mr. Dillon's, in executive session. I think that I would rather answer it in executive session, if I may.
Yeah, you sure don't want to give out the names of those employees you have working in CBS, NBC, all the top media sources, do you? Not for the public to hear.
Well, I have a series of additional questions that would follow on to that in executive session. I have here, Mr. Colby.
No.
Do you have further response to that?
No.
I have two books here. One is the Penkovsky Papers, and the other is the Blue Class by Prager Printers. What part did the CIA play in writing, publishing, and or distributing either one or both of these books?
I would like to discuss that in executive session, if I may, Mr. Dillon.
I don't know, Mr. Chairman, whether it's appropriate to ask the question of what is your explanation of white, black, and gray media operations? Would that also be more appropriate in executive session, or can you talk about it generally in open session?
I can describe that. This was a set of definitions that was worked out within the government about 15 years ago, more or less. White propaganda would be propaganda which is clearly attributed to the to its originator, something like Voice of America, something of that nature. The gray propaganda is material which is not attributed to the originator, and which there is some other attribution of the origin of the material. Black propaganda is material which is attributed to the target itself. In other words, a document which is pretends to be. We have had a number of those kinds of documents which were looked into by a House committee some years ago, distributed in Africa, alleging to be American Foreign Service telegrams and messages put out with communist support. We know that at that time. The document was falsely attributed to the United States. It was designed to show the United States in some bad light or other. That would be an item of black propaganda.
Thank you. Have the CIA ever planted or leaked stories to foreign press sources? And if the answer to that question is yes, were any of the stories false or in any way misleading?
As a part of our covert propaganda responsibilities, Mr. Dullums, we have provided a certain amount of information all over the world in the foreign press.
Has the CIA ever financed, published, or controlled, at least in part, newspapers, news services, journals, or periodicals in foreign nations? And if so, what was the general purpose?
Again, as a part of our responsibilities for covert political and propaganda action abroad, the answer, in a very broad sense, is yes. And I would like to go into detail in the executive session.
Thank you. Has the CIA ever asked U.S. journalists to write a particular story or express CIA-selected information?
With respect to foreign journalists and for foreign publication, The answer is yes.
U.S. journals.
With respect to American journals, the newsmen that we were discussing earlier, we make a particular point of not instructing them as to what they should write in the American media that they write for.
Has the CIA ever asked a media network or journal to ever kill a story?
I spent a great deal of my time in, earlier this year trying to get that done, Mr. Dellums. I think that's...
Is that the only instance?
No, there have been other times. There have been times I have appealed to the responsibility of journalists in America not to run a story.
Would the gentleman yield briefly to my colleague? Has there been any times in the last 2 weeks?
No. No, Mr. Clark.
I've asked this question several times, and I'm not sure if I've ever gotten a clear answer, but can you explain the nature of the relationship between the CIA and Prager Publishers?
I would rather go into that in detail in executive session, Mr. Dellums.
Has the CIA ever covertly assisted the publication, distribution, or writing of any article, book, or media presentation in the United States? Now, I may have missed your earlier comments.
I think I really have to explain that in executive session. I revert to my point that any activity we do in this field is aimed abroad.
Thank you, Mr.
Morgan
Chairman.
Murphy, a Democrat from Illinois.
CIA officers are assigned to the BNDD and its successor, the DEA?
Yes, there were certain at various times, Mr. Murphy.
And how about the DEA, DIA?
D-I-A?
D-I-A.
Yes.
The same answer to the Treasury Department?
Yes.
Are these CIA detailees ever asked to report back to the CIA as to what was happening at the organization in which they were detailed?
Well, certain of the CIA officers detailed to those organizations are detailed as liaison officers, in which case their function is to make sure that there's a full exchange of information between the two agencies on that job. Certain of them, however, are assigned to work in that area for a time, and they are given over to the full command authority of the organization to which they're sent.
Were there any CIA detailees, and possibly we can only go into this in executive session, detailed to cabinet officers in any administration?
Yes, certain occasions.
On a permanent basis, say a secretarial level or administrative assistant level?
I can think of one secretary that was detailed to the White House at one point, and an individual later became a cabinet officer and asked that she assist him in his new job.
He knew
at all times what she was, of course, in her background.
Were there any of the... members of cabinets that had CIA detailees that were unaware of their status as a CIA agent or former employee of the CIA?
Well, as for former, I cannot say. When they leave CIA and take another job somewhere else, CIA does not follow them or make any arrangements. As for current employees, any CIA detailee to another agency is revealed to the management of that agency.
Now, I think we established the fact that there were some detailees of the CIA detailed to the White House. Is that correct?
There are, yes.
And would they be reporting back on a regular basis to the CIA as to any and all activities within their purview in the White House?
No, I have instructed at least two or three of them that I know of that they are not to report to me what they learn in that job, except that... to the extent that their current employers, want them to do so. Some of them, as I say, are liaison officers, and for that reason, they are passing on decisions and passing on questions that they want to have studied from an intelligence point of view.
Oh, don't tell me we have spies in the White House. Surely not.
Are any of your CIA people used as interpreters in high-level discussions between foreign heads of governments and our government?
My Deputy General Walters has a reputation as one of the foremost interpreters in the world, and he has served, I think, almost every president in that position. He is a military officer. He was an attaché before and over a number of years,
but since he has become the Deputy Director of Intelligence, he has on occasion served as interpreter.
David Train, a Republican from Louisiana, questioning William Colby.
Colby, the 1964 activity that Mr. McClory referred to, and this has just come to my attention, so I'm not very familiar with the material that's been presented to us, but do I understand that the woman who picked up the copies of Senator Goldwater's speeches in the summer of 1964 was an employee of the CIA herself?
Apparently, yes. I believe, yes.
Employed by the Domestic Operations Division?
Yes.
Domestic Operations Division.
Who is this woman?
I don't know the name right now, Mr. Green. I'm sure I could find it out.
Do we know if she's still employed by the CIA?
She's apparently retired.
She's a retired CIA employee?
Retired.
But she can be identified, but we simply don't have her name at this time. Is that correct?
She was interviewed in the course of the Watergate hearings, in which I think some of this came up at one point for some reason.
Can anyone at the witness table tell us who this woman was?
I would like to supply the name. I don't know the name offhand.
You will supply the name.
I will supply the name.
I have no further questions this time.
Yes, I'll be pleased to you. One obvious question, Mr.
Colby. Morgan Murphy.
You detail any CIA employees at this committee or the church committee?
No, Mr. Murphy. Although, I'm not sure whether this committee, but I know the church committee has some former employees on it, but I have no connection with them.
Would the gentleman yield? I yield. Mr. McClure just asked me, Mr. Chairman.
Sometime. When you detail people to the White House, as this person, Cooper, was detailed to the White House, is the president or the people at the White House, are they advised that the CIA is putting somebody in the White House?
Well, the arrangements are made with the administrative elements there that they send an officer.
They're not secretly at the White House.
They're not secretly at the White House.
Clearly
a CIA identification, and we frequently are asked to send somebody. And Mr. Cooper was a good example. Mr. Cooper was very well informed on Vietnamese affairs, and he went over to help the National Security Council staff on Vietnamese affairs especially.
And then he reports, does he report back to the CIA?
No, he reported at that time to the National Security Council staff. I won't say he never had lunch with an old friend, but he certainly, his lines of reporting and his lines of authority were clear. While he worked over there, he worked for the National Security Council.
Who approved this operation, Mr. Colby, for this employee of the Domestic Operations Division, this woman? Who approved her activities and going and getting copies of speeches as an employee and delivering them to Mr. Cooper or through some other channel which ultimately reached Cooper?
I believe the record indicates that this was initiated by Mr. Barnes.
Who is deceased, is that correct?
Who is deceased?
Did he have to have approval from a higher-up?
I don't believe there's any indication that he ever asked for it or needed it.
Would you examine the records to see if you can find if Mr. Barnes left any evidence of where he got his authority to do this?
I will, Mr. Trent.
I'd be pleased to yield the chairman.
I have no question. There are questions been asked. Mr. Ashman.
Mr. Chairman, just to try, I don't know how many questions I can ask in open session, Mr. Colby, but just a couple of things about the stringers that have that are working or that are paid by the CIA. Are those, when you recruit people like that, is that at their suggestion or at your suggestion? Do you approach somebody that you think would be useful, or do they somehow come to you?
Well, both, Mr. Aspin, but any such operation is reviewed very, very carefully by Mr. Nelson as my deputy for operations. This is not done on the say-so of a subordinate officer somewhere, and a full consideration is taken of whether the man clearly is not a staff member of a general circulation journal or media, and secondly, that there be no
influence on the American opinion and press as a result.
So nothing that he writes, you don't try to influence his opinion of things
no.
that appear. How about a foreign publication that might appear in the United States, published abroad, but is distributed in the United States?
This is Les Aspin of Wisconsin.
Hers, you could publish it.
And of course, if a story appears in a foreign publication, it might be picked up by a wire service in this country as being a legitimate story.
Yeah, it could be at the far end. But that's not. I think that's a purely incidental effect of the activity, which is conducted abroad, with its objective abroad and with its impact abroad.
But it is possible, at least in these two kinds of instances, that something which has an impact abroad or its intentions impact abroad could, in effect, become part of the United States' knowledge about the subject. Or
yes, but on the basis of a number of years' experience of seeing this. I can think of the very, very few occasions on which any reference was made to any such event initiated by us abroad for a foreign target. There were very few. The one or two that I can recall, there was some reference to the fact that some event was alleged to have taken place abroad, but nothing of any prominence, nothing that really substantially misled the American people or anything of that nature.
These people are primarily then for planning a story abroad, or are they also for giving us information too?
No, they're primarily for intelligence collection purposes.
And maybe incidentally for planning a story.
And incidentally, sometimes, yes.
Now, when you deal with these people, do they get briefings from the CIA, and would they, for example, get classified briefings?
Well, we would certainly brief them on behavior so that they would conduct their clandestine work safely, and so that we would have our relationship and not be revealed in that relationship. At the same time, if they are covering some particular foreign situation, we have one of our officers is obviously going to sit down and debrief the man. In the course of a debrief, they discuss what some target situation is doing, and there is an exchange of views of what that means, what the significance, what events are apt to take place, and in the course of that, I'm sure some information does go back and forth.
Yeah, and the question is to me, does the person who is writing the story, is he knowledgeable about what he is doing, his role in this thing, or does he think he's in fact putting out straight information?
Oh, well, I think we've got two things confused now, and this is a very complicated area, but in the dealing with an intelligence collection agent abroad who happens to have some connection with journals, then we will talk with him, discuss with him the appreciation of what's going on in that area. If we, on the other hand, come to the idea that we want to have a certain event look as though it's taking place abroad, then we might discuss with him just exactly how that thing should be presented so that it will have its best effect in that foreign situation.
Does it happen that you have on the payroll in some way a person who writes regularly for a foreign publication, a columnist or something like that?
For a foreign publication, certainly.
And would it be part of the normal routine to perhaps slip him information and expect that he would therefore write a column from that information?
On occasion, that is possible.
And is it the times when the information that you give him is totally fabricated, documents made up to look like they were authentic when in fact they were totally fabricated?
Well, in fact, I wouldn't say it never happens, but it's a very rare event, because if he is going to be successful in that activity, he's got to develop the reputation for reliability that can only come from having a good, solid base of information.
Mr. Milford.
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask you to reserve my time.
Without objection, gentleman's time is reserved for the executive.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to correct one thing. I think I may have misstated in the answer to Mr. Treen.
Certainly.
The question of whether Mr. Cooper reported to us. Apparently the record is that there were reports filed by him as to his activities there in the White House while he was working, which were filed with our Deputy Director for Intelligence.
Mr. Kasten.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tobin.
Robert Kasten, a Republican from Wisconsin.
One of our CIA employees detailed to the National Security Council.
Well, one thing, for instance, we detail people to help run the Situation Room, which handles the incoming intelligence. We detail individuals to help on the consideration of some of the intelligence or covert action problems that take place. On some occasions, we detail individuals because they are very competent in their field and are chosen so, particularly because of their competence, that the National Security Council wants to borrow them and use them because of that skill.
Why are intelligence officers from the Directorate of Operations, the covert part of the CIA, always detailed to the 40 Committee?
Well, because
the covert operations section.
Then normally the work has been, is one of maintaining contact, a liaison, with respect to those covert operations. And an officer deals in that subject and maintains the liaison about those matters.
But isn't the 40 Committee supposed to be advising or at least passing judgment on recommendations for covert operations which would be coming from the CIA? In fact, it would be coming from the CIA Directorate of Operations section, the section that they had just left.
No, but the 40 Committee are the principals of the committee. The officer that acts as the executive secretary of it merely processes the material, makes sure that the right information is at the right time, and things of that nature.
The officer,
he's not making a judgment about the things. That's made by the members of the committee,
of which
I am one.
The officer who serves as the executive secretary of the 40 Committee, I understand these are undercover people right now, and that we shouldn't use their names, but generally speaking, they leave the DDO, go to work with the 40 Committee, the NSC, then they come back and they stay working in covert action. Now, it seems that there's a conflict when you're sending a person from the CIA, a high-ranking officer in the CIA, he's undercover, he then goes to work advising on covert operations. Can't he influence decisions? It's not independent judgment in any way. He would have a special interest in one case, if the timing was right, he could have developed the plans for a covert operation, and then next month he becomes the individual advising the 40 Committee. He's over in the White House with his other hat. Isn't this a conflict?
No, I don't think so, Mr. Kasten. The thing is that you take a man who knows something about the subject matter about which he's going to be working. In other words, covert actions. He understands it. He understands how it works, how the machinery works, how the operations take place abroad. He is detailed over there to do the secretary's job, the executive secretary's job for the committee. He takes a tour there. He doesn't cut his ties with his career. Just by going over there for a time, he comes back and gets reassigned to some other job. During the time he's there, though, it is clear that he works for the 40 Committee. There's no doubt as to who he's working for.
Are the members of the 40 Committee and other 40 Committee staff people aware that their executive secretary is a CIA covert action detailee?
Certainly. No question about that. They know exactly who he is and that he comes from CIA and that he comes from if they're curious, that he comes from the Directorate of Operations. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Now, listening to that section, this is the House Intelligence Committee. You have to wonder, you know, where are they at? Of course someone from the Directorate of Operations and Covert Operations is going to maintain their contacts, because their term doesn't end by sitting at the NSC for a year, 2 years. They go back to work. And they're pretty good at what they do. Who knows what instructions they've been given while they're sitting with the NSC, or who knows who in the NSC really knows what their prior capacity was. Not many, I guarantee. So there you've heard DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, Bill Colby, testifying before the Pike Committee. What was he testifying about? Primarily, he was talking about Project Mockingbird, Operation Mockingbird, Those were the primary questions from the committee members wanting to know how the assets are recruited, how the assets are used, and how the information fed to those assets can affect them, the American people. I leave it up to your own judgment as to how that may have affected you. API, UPI, British Broadcasting, CBS, NBC, all of them fed information. Sometimes false, sometimes just a little bit twisted to the way they want it to go, but always in favor of the CIA operation, always in favor of the manner in which the CIA wants that information dictated. And remember, that was the 70s. That was before the internet. Now we have the internet. And you know, I talked a little bit about the National Defense Appropriations Act and these trillions of dollars and millions, billions, and trillions of dollars. A lot of that money, in my mind, a lot of that money from the Department of Defense, a large portion of it, not the majority, but a portion of it now, counterintelligence and social media. I know that in the military, you can attain 15 names now, not only 10. Each military member, each person working in that position to scope the internet, get into Facebook, get into Twitter, get into all the different social networks, support the desires of the command element daily. There's briefings for them. This is what we're looking for today. This is how we're going to approach this today. Okay, go after this, go after that, go after this, and it's there. I mean, you can see the trolls all over the internet, and believe me, they are not who they pretend to be.
Do you ever encounter people on certain forums, message boards, or conversation threads online that are unabashedly pro-US? Now, I'm sure you're thinking, yes, of course, why would that be strange? There are a lot of people out there supportive of the US government engaging in conversations in the social media world. But I don't mean those people. I mean the online personas that, oddly enough, are unrelenting in their patriotic vitriol and troll for literally hours trying to debunk legitimate questions or any opposition to the establishment. Sometimes it almost seems like these people might even be getting paid to do it. I mean, how else could they expel that insane amount of time and energy on these comment threads trying to argue how wrong you are? Well, this might be old news to some, but last year it was confirmed that the U.S. military has been manipulating social media by using fake identities to influence conversations and spread pro-American propaganda. It's called Online Persona Management Services. And under the CENTCOM contract, it allows the creation of up to 10 sock puppet accounts for every U.S. serviceman or woman working on the program. The stipulations are that every fake persona must have a convincing background, history, and supporting friend networks so that it will remain undetectable from even the most sophisticated adversaries. According to The Guardian, the project has been likened by web experts to China's attempts to control and restrict free speech on the internet, and that critics are saying that it allows the U.S. military to create a false consensus in online conversations, crowd out unwelcome opinions, and smother commentaries or reports that do not correspond with its own objectives. Now, of course, according to CENTCOM, their only objective is to counter violent extremists and enemy propaganda outside of the US, and that it would be unlawful to address US audiences with the technology. Wow, unlawful, really? Interesting, because the newest version of the 2013 NDAA included an interesting amendment. This amendment legalized domestic propaganda on the American public. You heard me right. The newest NDAA wasn't just reauthorizing the indefinite detention of American citizens. It also allowed the U.S. government to legally carry out misinformation campaigns against the citizens of this country. But is this really surprising to anyone? I mean, the corporate media is basically a propaganda arm of the U.S. government anyways, isn't it? In fact, aside from everything I just mentioned, the Pentagon already spends $4 billion a year to influence public opinion, and the Department of Defense also spends hundreds of millions of dollars on information campaigns in countless countries occupied by the U.S. military. But perhaps even more disturbing than all of this is the fact that the CIA has already been infiltrating the biggest press institutions since the early 1950s. One has to look no further than Operation Mockingbird, a secret CIA campaign to spread disinformation and false stories to foreign governments during the Cold War. It did this by manipulating the media into focusing on propaganda, sabotage, and subversion. That was later revealed in congressional hearings that the CIA program consisted of literally paying off editors and reporters at most mainstream news outlets. The New York Times, CBS, Time, The Washington Post, Newsweek, AP, Reuters, and countless more. In one instance, a journalist named Joseph Alsop, who's alleged to have been one of the most prominent journalists working under Operation Mockingbird, wrote foreign affairs articles that appeared in over 300 publications. So, isn't it nice to know that the supposed watchdogs of the government can be so easily bought? Even though the intent of this program was to focus on matters outside of this country, it undoubtedly influenced everyone living here at the time. People to this day could still be reading and referencing these articles, not knowing that they're completely fake. And sure, this is more than 50 years ago, but let's face the facts here. Our media is much worse now and has been much more easily compromised now. So how do we know that Operation Mockingbird still isn't in effect? Well, we don't. So, the next time you sit down to read the Sunday paper or visit an online forum, just remember, don't believe everything you read.
So be careful. You have to be able to carefully discern, and I mean this, carefully discern what you hear out there. Come on, folks. There's so much stuff going on out there. You see these people that claim that they were in the Clinton administration. Let me give you an example. Claim that they were in the Clinton administration, and they may have been in the Clinton administration while he was governor and worked for the governor. And as time goes on, all of a sudden this person becomes, when the Iran-Contra thing blows out and North is fired, this person becomes the guy in charge of Iran-Contra and all that. All the full operation. Well, that's a bunch of bullshit. That person is kind of old, has been out of the system for a long time, and just wants to further his attention in the internet. Be careful of these kind of people. Be careful of these kind of people that are coming in all the time and claiming new information, even though they're 70, 80, 90 years old, you know, and new information about current events. Because believe me, they're making it up. They're building a story to try to make themselves self-important again. So, you hear me talk about things I know, things I was involved in. You know, we just talked about Colby. He was my boss. I respected the man. I mourned his death. He was a good intelligence officer. But he was an intelligence officer. I think that's enough said there. Folks, feel free to visit my website, www.chiptatum.com, www.chiptatum.com. There you'll find the bookstore where I've included Operation Red Rock. It's the story of a false flag in Cambodia during the Nixon administration. And the Tatum Chronicles, which is the story of drug running, guns for drugs during the Iran-Contra under the watchful eyes of George H.W. Bush and Oliver North. Oh, I can't forget Bill Clinton in that either. And now that the new Barry Seal show is coming out, Barry was a friend, and he was involved in flying drugs to the U.S. out of Honduras. I'm going to call it a night. I've got this lousy cold coming on. It's been on for a few days now. So I'm going to call it a night. I want to say to all of you, good night. This is Chip Tatum signing off of the Pegasus Files for the night. Good night. But first, listen to this one more time.